Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of Seriously Risky Business. My name, of course, is Patrick Gray, and this podcast is brought to you by Proofpoint. And for those who are not familiar, Seriously Risky Biz is the podcast that I do with Tom Uren after I've finished helping him edit his weekly newsletter, which is also called Seriously Risky Business. And, you know, Seriously Risky Biz looks at more macro trends, big picture things, government policy, that sort of stuff. And of course, Tom Uren is the author of that newsletter. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Pat. How are you?
Good, good. And yeah, look, you know, you did something unusual for the newsletter this week, which is, you know, the feature piece at the top. You know, normally there's like three, and this week you just dived into one and really did a deep dive, and another magnum opus, we'll call it. And you really looked at the trajectory of crime phones, right? From being a criminal's best friend to these days being a cop's best friend, if we're going to be honest. And the reason you did this is because there were a couple of crime phone related stories in the news this week. A bunch of defendants challenged the legality of a crime phone sort of surveillance operation run by the authorities in the United Kingdom. And also there was another story from Vice Motherboard, which took a look at a outfit called, somewhat hilariously, Number One Business Communication, which is the crime phone, which is gaining a bit of traction with the Calabrian Mafia. So what you've done is you've really looked at the history of how law enforcement action against these types of outfits has evolved from just taking them down and charging the operators to actually infiltrating them and collecting evidence on everyone using those devices. And yeah, I mean, once you put it all in one place, like you have here, it's a pretty wild ride.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. I knew many of these stories beforehand, and before I'd done all this looking at it, I'd kind of thought that there was this vague balance between law enforcement and criminals. And no. I was thinking that, you know, when are criminals going to change their approach? Are they going to do something different, or are they just wedded to crime phones? And afterwards, I think, no, actually, there's no balance. Cops are winning.
Yeah.
And criminals are not going to move away from crime phones. So I sort of thought perhaps that beforehand they might use consumer technology. But there's just a whole surprisingly large swath or collection of these stories stretching back for the last, like, from 2016. And the Dutch police have been in the vanguard, in that they've been the sort of lead investigators for more than half of these takedowns. But they've evolved from, like you said, just stopping the network to actually doing a lot of work to get access to the network.
So one of the various means too, right? Like, and even there was the Anom case where the FBI actually ran the network, which was quite funny. But, you know, you've sort of walked through, you know, the on the face of it advantages for criminals of using these things. They're supposed to be well encrypted, but they also do other things as well. Like, they disable the GPS camera and microphone, right? So that, you know, all of that GPS data isn't available to authorities if someone gets arrested. Funnily enough, though, in the case of Anom, which was the crime phone network operated by the FBI that would CC the FBI and its partners on basically every message sent over the network, you noted something funny in here, which I did not know, which is that they'd set it up to geotag every message that anyone ever sent, so you knew where they were when they sent it, and dump that into a giant law enforcement database, which is amazing.
Yeah, Anom was also interesting in that there's all these trade-offs that you can kind of see here. Like, if you take out the camera, then you can't use the camera to send photos of the drug haul to your associates.
Yeah.
So, removing the camera makes sense, and it's something that people talked about in classified environments. Can you take a phone in, remove the camera, remove a microphone? You know, maybe you could use the useful stuff without risking classified information. But that's what, when it came to Anom, that's what crooks were doing. They were, you know, proof of receipt and here's what you're going to get. So the camera is useful. So you can only
Anom enabled cameras did it?
Yeah. And part of the evidence was the photos sent over Anom.
Oh, now I remember. Yeah, there were photos of like torture chambers inside shipping containers and stuff, like really crazy stuff.
Yeah. So there's the odd piece of information that I didn't put in there that just reminds you that this is a serious subject. There are like serious criminals who do horrible, horrible things. Torture chambers is one of them. Many murders. So it is a serious subject. The first kind of examples police seem to have just sort of opportunistically taken advantage if, for example, say the key happened to be stored with the server, on the server. And so one of the very first takedowns, the Dutch police noticed the encryption key was on the server. They got access
probably,
to the
it probably
server.
Would have been multiple keys rather than one key, though, right?
Yeah. I think the reporting kind of, reduces things, so it's hard to know the exact technical detail, but yes.
Yeah, I'm guessing it was keyed per user, but they left them lying around, which is, you know, very nice of them to do that for us.
Yeah, that's right. And then the later ones, it's our purpose is to get access to the messages. So, for example, again, the Dutch in 2020, they pushed malware down to this network called EncroChat. And so that was built basically using the Signal protocol. And so presumably the actual encryption was good, stores keys stored on device. But when you've got police powers and you can get access to the server, then there's all sorts of opportunities. So that to me seems to be the fundamental problem for criminals. You've got to have a server somewhere and you've got to have people somewhere. And both of those key pieces of human and IT capital can be subverted.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, at its essence, it is pretty simple, isn't it? Which is, if you're going to run criminal infrastructure, if that criminal infrastructure is in a jurisdiction that that's at all, law enforcement friendly, I mean, you're kind of screwed. And even if it's not, you know, we've seen in the past that law enforcement agencies don't mind doing a bit of hacking. You know, if they can hack into one of these things under a court ordered authorization and distribute the malware through hacking, because the server's based in Venezuela or whatever, I mean, they're going to do that.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be any easy answer for for anyone. If you're trying to hide from the power of a competent state, it just becomes very, very difficult.
And yeah, so I mean, one thing that's interesting too in all of this, right, and it's worth repeating, is that a lot of these, operations, they're European police, they're Australian police. You know, when the FBI is involved, it's more as a facilitator, because they can't do the same sort of stuff that Europeans and we here in Australia can do, which is to go to a court and say, these are crime phones, so we're going to, listen in on all of them because they're planning crime stuff, because of the Fourth Amendment in the United States. You can't really listen to someone's communications before you know who they are and that they're engaged in something dodgy. The bar is just that much higher, which is why the FBI wound up essentially handing over the ANOM operation to us. So it really does seem like, from a law enforcement perspective, the US is operating at a handicap here. From a privacy rights perspective, maybe not so much.
Yeah, so at a very high level, what you said seems to be true, in the sense that from a privacy perspective, theoretically US
privacy
citizens,
from law enforcement as opposed to privacy from Facebook and Google.
Yeah, that's right. I actually think the practical impact is that US citizens are worse off, though, because there's just absolutely no evidence at all that anyone law-abiding uses these types of phones. And so,
I agree with you, but you just gave all of our American listeners a stroke by criticizing one of their constitutional amendments. They don't like it when you do that, Tom.
I'm just pointing out the truth here, the hard, cold truth.
The hard truth. That's
and
what this show is all about.
What is hilarious, that the ANOM operation, the FBI ran the service. They basically handed it over to the AFP. The AFP arrested hundreds and hundreds of people, tons of drug shipments. They needed thousands of police to arrest all the criminals they were locking up. And at the same time, the FBI arrested 17 people for selling and distributing FBI devices.
Yeah. I love that, how they arrested them for distributing the devices that they themselves were making, which is quite a sting in the tail. But, ultimately, the only charges the FBI and the DOJ in the US got out of this was over the actual operation of the network, right?
Yeah. And so so they pursued a strategy there, the AFP and FBI, of marketing them through criminal channels. And that seems to be sensible from a legal perspective of keeping the scope tight. But there's also like absolutely no evidence that any real person ever buys any of these devices. So the very one of the first ones, Phantom Secure, they tried to market it to celebrities as a kind of privacy-enhanced phone. But, I mean, just frankly, no one's prepared to pay the money that these phones ask for.
Yeah. Well, and we got Signal now for that, right? Like, we've actually got, like, if you're a celebrity, an iPhone's probably going to be good enough. If you're a, you know, transnational heroin criminal, right? Like, probably not. And that's kind of the point, and that's a good place to be. But you did point out, yeah, I mean, Phantom Secure launched in 2008. And it took a while before they sort of found their niche, which turned out to be enabling crime.
Yeah, that's right. And for a long time, Phantom Secure was a problem. So it ran, like in 2014, there's stories about how it was unbreakable. And
yeah,
I think it was a huge success to take down that network. That network, they didn't get access to messages. So apparently the founder, Vincent Ramos, I think his name was, he was asked if he would employ or put malware down on the network, and he didn't say yes, which is interesting that the he was Canadian. So I think in an Australian context nowadays, you'd be able to compel someone to do that
well, with the laws that we have. But I mean, you know, they locked him up for a long time.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely in jail.
Yeah, but presumably they would have given him a better deal if he cooperated, right?
Yes.
So whether or not there's powers to compel is kind of neither here nor there. I think the interesting thing about the Phantom Secure takedown, though, is it was a step towards this more modern policing of this stuff, in that when they shut it down, Anom was ready to go. And the message was out that, hey, you know, Phantom Secure is going away, but everybody should rush onto this platform, right? And that's exactly what happened. And it's kind of like there are so many similarities in all of this between like Silk Road, right? So when Silk Road got shut down, everyone went to like Silk Road 2, and the FBI was already running the joint, you know, and they shut it down, and then they went here and the FBI were already there, and then they shut it down. And, you know, this is another thing that was a sort of technology enabled, you know, crime ecosystem that people thought was impervious to law enforcement. And then eventually it got flipped on its head. And I certainly feel that this is similar in that, you know, it's hard to remember a time when these devices were actually causing law enforcement trouble, because the reversal has been so extreme.
Yeah, so I actually go through a list, and we've mentioned just three of them. There's also Sky ECC, this one I hadn't heard of called XClue, EncroChat, PGB Safe, and EnetCom. And they've happened every year or twice a year since 2016. And typically what happens is that these networks operate within certain geographies and across geographies within, I guess, within criminal networks. So they may be transnational, but they're amongst criminals that deal with each other, obviously. Mm. And so I speculate about what's going to happen next.
Well, hang on. Because before we get there, there's this really, really interesting part of this piece that you've written, which didn't occur to me, to be honest. It's just something that I hadn't thought of. And when I read it, I'm like, oh my God, of course. Which is that law enforcement, a couple of Europol officers have made the point that not only have these things been useful at collecting evidence, but they are achieving never before seen levels of insight into criminal organizations, because the extent to which, you know, organized crime groups trust these devices is extraordinary. They lay out all of their plans. They're sending photos of their operations. They just talk freely because they really believe the marketing hype around the devices. So it's just all there. So that's an unexpected twist in all of this, which is, okay, some of these organizations, they won't be able to arrest everyone involved, but they've got blueprints to the way these operations work that just didn't exist before. And I just found that fascinating.
Yeah, that was a great piece in The New Yorker, and it's linked to in the newsletter. I think it's well worth a read. The guy actually says that they found new figures in organized crime that they were just totally unaware of.
Yeah, they found the stealth Mr. Phones. Biggs.
And so to me, that's interesting in that the presence of that technology changed the way that criminals operated. So presumably they'd been taking some other sort of ComSec measure, communication security measure, beforehand when they were using non-encrypted devices. I don't know what that was. And so...
Yeah, but I'm guessing it was going to be lower volume, right?
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
That's the thing about secure comms is it enables you to like turbocharge your crime.
Yeah.
There you go. There's a marketing tagline for the next crime phone company. Turbocharge your crime with, you know, risky biz phone.
Yeah.
That could work.
Yeah, it seems like they're hanging on to the benefits of this new technology. Like they want smartphones, even though... So the story about number one business communication becoming popular amongst the Italian mafia. The previous week, 132 of them were arrested because of the takedowns of Sky ACC and EncroChat. So they know that they're getting arrested, but they can't stay away. It's like catnip for criminals. We must have one of these phones.
And the way that you end this piece is quite funny, which is you point out that, you know, as per Joe Cox's reporting in Vice, they pushed out an update with new certificates earlier this year, and the piece ends with, "Don't worry, guys, I'm sure it's fine." Nothing to worry about. But yeah, you did make the point, though, and this is what you were getting to earlier when I interrupted you, but you made the point here that where you think this is going is that some of the larger, you know, criminal organizations may... Because they've been backing these crime phone organizations, right? Like quite often the seed money that comes in to start these things up actually comes from criminals. So they might just take it in-house and develop their own. And this is actually something that was the done thing before crime phones kind of emerged, right? Like so before crime phones, there was this trend or early indications that the larger cartels and whatever were actually developing their own devices, and you think it could happen again.
Yeah. So the story I talk about is El Chapo. So Joaquin Guzman, who's head of the Sinaloa cartel, he found an IT guy who happened to be working in the Geek Squad, which is like a Best Buy sort of install your computer.
Yeah, we'll come to your home and fix your mouse or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So he's working in the Geek Squad in Medellin, Colombia, and he was hired by Guzman to build a secure communication network. So he built an encrypted voice over IP network. And Guzman also got him to install spyware on his wife's phone and also his mistress's phone and also people he didn't trust. So he had this network of spying on his own organization. And I guess this is one of the stories that makes me think that it's a fool's errand. Christian Rodriguez was his name, and he got turned by the FBI. And it turns out that working for a murderous drug lord is not a very relaxing job. And so Rodriguez doesn't sound like he was too hard to turn. And I guess in that environment, you're always worried that you're going to get killed. And so the only people who can offer you any kind of hope of survival are someone like the FBI or some law enforcement body outside of your own country. And so I think that's the opportunity where the sort of internal dynamics of how crime gangs work,
there are going to be points of vulnerability there, right?
Yeah, that's right. The people who rise to the top are not sane, rational, new age bosses who...
But this is the whole thing that makes this fascinating, right? Is and we were talking about this before we started recording, but it's like, yeah, the people at the top of these organizations are kind of, you know, built a bit different, right? And they're the big brain boss who says, "We're going to build a secure thing. You know, go get me a guy from Geek Squad and we're going to do this," right? So they just don't seem to really understand the risks that this introduces, and nor can we really expect these criminal masterminds to actually understand what it takes to build, you know, surveillance resistant communications technology, because as it turns out, it's quite hard. And it not only has to be resistant against technical attacks and attacks against its infrastructure, but as you point out, attacks against vulnerable people who are working on this stuff, who might possess key material, passwords, SSH keys, whatever, who, you know, if the FBI comes along and says, "How would you like witness relocation to, you know, country of your choice, and we'll get you out of this situation?" I mean, for them, that's like a heavenly proposition, right? So
yeah,
it's unlikely that it's going to work. I mean, we also had another example here, and I mean, whether or not it's a criminal organization, I mean, kind of more like a war crimey organization, but you know, there was that hacking of the Wagner Evgeny Prigozhin's network. Yeah. Right, which included the IT assets belonging to the Wagner Group. And they'd built their own secure communications device, which wasn't secure. Like, if you were on their Windows network, you could get in the middle of all of their supposedly secure messages. And if activists were doing that, I guarantee you, like, every single SIGIN agency worth its salt was all up in their business, right, for quite a long amount of time. But and here's the rub. Criminals, when it comes to this stuff, aren't that smart, which is why, you know, we're describing this thing that we think is going to be a trend, which is really dumb, but they're still going to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's worse than that they're not that smart. It's that they've actually got character flaws that means that they'll make dumb choices.
Yeah.
And so they'll choose...
It's like a special kind of hubris, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why they're successful as crime lords, because they're brutal. You know, they have operate on gut instinct. They'll murder people who look at them the wrong way, and they'll trust people who look at them the right way, regardless of their actual fundamental underlying skills. And also, that behavior means that they're like Rodriguez. He actually had a breakdown, so he was driven to, I think he got shock therapy, so pretty serious.
Wow.
Effect on him. And that's the sort of person who like a law enforcement agency can get some traction with. So I think there's this dilemma. Now, I don't think every crime in encrypted crime phone is going to be broken by police, but I think that there's really good reasons to think that they'll have success a lot of the time. And so
I think something that we've sort of established already in this conversation is that when they do have success, it's pretty spectacular. It's recordings of incriminating conversations at El Chapo's trial. It's pictures of torture chambers. It's insight into every single detail of large criminal organizations. And that's the thing, like the stakes for these organizations are so much higher than they seem to realize.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you were going to mention that Signal in the US.
Yeah. So after, this is interesting, right? Because clearly serious criminals can't trust, and I don't mean just like your average sort of middling heroin dealer or whatever. I mean serious professional, high-level criminals. They can't really rely on commodity iPhones because of what I like to call the Mark Dowd problem, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, Signal, it's not going to get intercepted on the wire. But if you're a big enough target, you're going to get some very expensive Mark Dowd delivered spyware dropped on your device. And they know that. They seem to be scared of that, right? Like, they seem to know that this is an issue. And in fact, I think there's a general perception among criminals that that is easier than it is. Do you know what I mean? They think it's easier to do that than it is.
Yeah, I think, I wonder if that's just the heritage of, you could never trust a phone in the old days.
Yes. I think there was probably a
period up until, what, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago where an iPhone did seem pretty secure. There weren't any of these stories about, you know, NSO, zero click.
Yeah, but keep in mind, like 5 years ago, Signal was brand new as well, right? So there were, you know, you still had sort of limited options. But I think you're right. I think it's the legacy of telephones not being trustworthy. But I remember reading in New York, and it's amazing how much this didn't get repeated anywhere else. I mean, to even find this reference, I'd be Googling for an hour. But there was a New York Times report into the Sinaloa cartel, and it contained a really interesting tidbit, which is that when the cartel would send its people into the United States on business, their standard operating procedure was to give them a brand new iPhone, put Signal on it, you know, all fresh keys, fresh SIMs, fresh everything. They'd roll into the United States, they'd use the phones, they'd come back, and those phones would go straight into a log chipper. So that's why I think, you know, that's a sort of OPSEC measure that works, because it's simple, it requires discipline, but it's going to work. Right? That's going to cause serious problems for any organization unless they can get like a advanced knowledge of the SIMs or whatever. Like that, it's a good OPSEC measure. Whereas when you want to try to do an actual network that allows you to freely communicate messages that would be used as evidence against you over an extended period of time with identifiers in the network that don't change, even if you've got that OPSEC part right, which it looks like, you know, obviously the Sinaloa cartel, there's a lot of ex-military and whatnot involved who know about OPSEC. But when it comes to building this network that I just described that allows long-term communications between, you know, nodes with identifiers that don't change, carrying sensitive stuff, you know, I just really wonder, even a competent criminal organization would have trouble building anything that's going to stand up over time to hacking, to even crypto flaws, and to pressure applied to insiders by law enforcement. So I just think this whole thing is a very... I just wonder if it can be done.
Yeah,
what I'm saying. I just wonder if you can have a crime phone.
Yeah, I don't think you can, like, after reading about it. At least not all the time. I think you can have it for some time, but the problem with a crime phone is it gives law enforcement a target to go after.
Yeah.
So that example of Signal in the States, it's a short-term thing. There's nothing to grab onto, really. But once you try to set up your own network, there's the people and the infrastructure. And so the story about Guzman, it all starts with an FBI or DEA agent getting an informant saying that they've set up a network. And that immediately starts them on the hunt for who's the administrator of the network. And that was the key piece of information that they needed to find. And if you're just using Signal, there is no one. If you're just using Signal for 2 or 3 days, there's no one to go after.
Yeah, exactly. So I think really what we're saying here is crime phones are dead, even though criminals don't quite realize it yet.
Long live the crime phone.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Tom, you're in. Fascinating discussion. Awesome work this week. You know, everyone should go and read this newsletter post. It's it was just a great summary of like just so much. You crammed so much in there. Terrific stuff. And I'll look forward to chatting with you again next week. Cheers.
Thanks, Pat.